most dramatic and most important critical period in the life of the Union.
This is take number three, the morning of January 6, 1961, Mr. President. You were explaining the position of Stevens and his opposition to the feeling that Lincoln had that the states ought to be, the rebel states ought to be readmitted as, not as conquered people, but as equals again.
The approach to the thing, and Andrew Johnson's approach, was that the states who had been under the secession movement should be considered, and that they ought to be treated as bad children, and that they should then be allowed to rehabilitate themselves on the basis of those people who were Union people, and a great many people in the South were, and that eventually the whole state should be readmitted to the Union and be allowed to elect its congressmen and senators. And Thad Stevens didn't want that to happen because he was very much afraid, and he had a right to be afraid, that the radical Republicans would then lose control not only of the Congress, but of the country as a whole.
Well, Mr. President, wasn't the Stevens approach really historically the old human approach that those who rebel should be punished, even if you use that as a pretext, because as you point out, the radicals would lose their power.
That's true. What he was trying to do was to make the situation appear as if the South was a conquered country. Andrew Johnson and Abraham Lincoln didn't want to make it appear that way. They wanted to take the South back as soon as they were willing to confess that they'd been wrong, take the oath of allegiance, and go ahead from there on, because the slaves had been freed. There wasn't any reason to do any more of the things necessary that are done in a conquered country. And old Thad Stevens was one of these fellows who wanted to pulverize his enemies. And he was trying to make the South appear as a conquered country. And Johnson and Lincoln didn't want that to happen.
Well, Mr. President, just one more question along that line. What I'm trying to ask is specifically, wasn't that the old idea of punishment?
Oh, yes.
Because I want to get to later
that
on.
That was the idea of the conquerors of in the Middle Ages, when the conquered countries leaders were executed, and that's what Johnson wanted to do.
I think we can get into the motivations, though. I think you'll find that the motivations are much more selfishly involved than generally disposed, because
yes,
in the North it was political control, in the South it was economic problems, and in the White House it was the problem of maintaining a union, which was a combination of humanitarian approach in treatment and a overall political approach in the question of conduct.
That had its effect on the whole thing, but then there were two approaches to the thing. Lincoln and Johnson wanted to approach the thing in a manner of forgiveness and come back and be good boys and behave yourselves from now on. And Thad Stevens and his crowd wanted to approach the thing in a manner that would cause the people who had tried to break up the Union to be punished by prison, by hanging, and by things of that sort. In fact, they put Jefferson Davis in prison for a while, the president of the Confederate government, and did everything they possibly could, Stevens and his crowd, to get a great many of the leaders in the South executed. Even went so far as to want to put R.E. Lee in jail. And I'll say this for Grant, he wouldn't stand for it.
But again, to the political thing, Mr. President, didn't Stevens and his crowd insist that from there on, the sole ruling party in the United States, the perpetual ruling party in the United States, would be the Republican Party?
That's right. That's right. And the Republicans had stolen the name from Thomas Jefferson. They weren't really Republicans, they were Federalists.
But
Well, what I'm trying to do, Mr. President, is to build a bridge to what has been happening in recent history as of this century, and that is a feeling that they just don't take conquered people and keep them in bondage or slavery. And I think you exemplified in your presidency your vast tolerance in which you tried to help conquered people, the people who were conquered.
Well,
so
yes.
I was trying to get back to the motivation of Stevens on that. He was really motivated outside of all these political things.
He was motivated by a middle-aged approach to the thing, and the present period has been the other way, to be tolerant of the people who are conquered and try to revive them and resuscitate them to the point where they will, when they finish up their recovery, will be the friends of the conqueror. And that's the procedure that was followed after World War I, after World War II.
In other words, you were for Reconstruction at the very earliest moment that the hostilities were over and to get on back to
that's
restoration.
True. That's true, because there was a great many of the instances of the people who were overwhelmed. A great number of people in those countries were not in favor of what happened. And we had to meet the situation so as to get the ones who were in favor of what happened to understand that the other people were right.
Mr. President, this year there's because of the centenary of the Civil War, there's a great revival of interest in the Civil War. Yet I find that most of the interest centers on the battles. From everything that we've heard from you in the last 2 days, what you are emphasizing is some of the factors which have still an influence on American politics and American political life and the attitude between the North and South. Don't you think more attention should be paid to those factors?
Oh, yes, I think that's true. Although those of us who are interested in military maneuvers are always very much interested in the battle maneuvers of the war between the states, and they've been used as an example in the military schools abroad and at home. But the objective that most of us ought to have in mind is that the idea of the wind-up of a killing war should be to restore good feeling between the enemies that were on each side of the line in those wars, and try to arrange things so that people will understand that war is a useless procedure. Yet, as long as the human animal is built like he is, I suppose we'll have them, but I hope we'll never have another one in my time.
Well, you're not in favor that of romancing the actual conduct of war as you are in the causes and consequences of war.
That's the truth. That's absolutely the truth. That's all we're after, is not to make too much of a romance out of conquest and what comes with it, as to try to find out what happens to the conquered and what can be done to rehabilitate them and put them back in a proper position so they'll be a part of the improvement of the world as a whole.
In other words, you see no glory to any adventures into war, no matter how many heroes it produces.
No, although I like to read about the heroes. No, you're right.
But you have a feeling that life must go on, and the only sure way that it can go on peacefully is to try to bridge over those things which broke down governmental procedures or agreements and led to war.
That's right. That's the reason I was always strong for the United Nations, and I've always been strong for the League of Nations, and the United Nations is its successor for that very purpose of trying to maintain peace in the world, if it can be done. We've got a proposition right now facing us with Cuba and Laos and all those things.
But you don't support the theory that once hostilities are over, that the disease of war and all that it brings forth perpetuated. You want to eradicated and cleansed quickly.
Yes, and if we can get a situation set up in world affairs such as was finally set up after the war between the states with the United States, that is the 48, 50 independent states under a federal government, if we can get the world set up on the same basis, I think we can settle our difficulties without going to war by settling them through judicial approach. Just as when Kansas sued Colorado on account of the Arkansas River water, they didn't go to war, they didn't call out the National Guard, they went to court and let the court settle it. If we could do that same thing with all the countries that make up the United Nations, then we would not have anything maybe but local trouble along the border sometimes without having to go to an all-out war as we did in 1914 and as we did in 1944.
I would like to take you back to a point that you've made from time to time that seems to startle a great many people, that you drew a distinction as between, in referring to the problem with the South, a distinction as between the political equality and the social equalities that seem to get mixed up all the time, and as between the Northern radicals and the Southern radicals, that social equality always was driven into a point of irritation.
Well, and that shouldn't be brought into the matter. What we want is political equality and economic equality, regardless of race, creed, or color. But when it comes to social matters, a man has a right to pick his associates. He doesn't have to go to parties that he doesn't approve of. He doesn't have to have people at his house that he doesn't want in the place. I remember one time in 1940 when I was having the bitterest campaign I ever had. Some of the smart alecks in these extreme, radically liberals, they call themselves, came to see me and wanted to know when I was going to invite certain people to my house for dinner. I said, never. The 5,000 people in my town I don't invite to dinner. I invite the friends that I want for dinner. And you can go and take that for what it's worth. I never heard any more about it. Because that's a part of our own setup. We don't have to personally associate socially with people that we know all around us. There are plenty of people that I don't like that I don't ask in my house. There are plenty of them that I do like that I always ask there. But that's a different thing. It's political and economic equality that we're fighting for all around the world. And when people get that idea, we won't have any more trouble. The Southerners always bring in this social equality thing, and it doesn't mean a thing.
Well, in other words, but you would not agree that certain social obligations have to be met in order that a person should have economic and political equality.
Oh, no, that's a different thing. That's a different thing. I'm talking about my own house at home. I'll decide who comes into my front door. Nobody else can do it for me.
Well, they got mixed up in a lot of these terms between the Northern pamphleteers and these radicals in the Congress. They kept talking about racial equality, and they kept driving it home to the South that there is racial and social equality.
It was done purposely to cause as much trouble as possible. And you find that a great many of these organizations who have to hire secretaries and make money do these things so they can keep getting funds to come in. It doesn't mean a darn thing, because the thing that we're fighting for all the way around the world is economic and political equality. And the social part of it is your own business. It's nobody else's.
This is the end of tape 3, the morning of January the 6th. This is tape number 4, the morning of January 6, 1961. Mr. President, I just want to jump back to one of the points you've illuminated, and that is the point about war. War has been described as an instrument of politics in another form. What is your feeling about that?
War is an instrument of diplomacy and politics when settlements cannot be made without it. And that's been the customary procedure ever since the great nations were established in the world. But it's my opinion that that situation can be overcome if we can succeed in getting the United Nations to work as a place to settle difficulties, just as we have succeeded in getting it done among the 48 states of the United States, 50 states now.
Do you rate all wars as having been inevitable?
Most of them are inevitable. Most of them are inevitable. A great many of them are religious, as we talked about yesterday. And those religious ones were absolutely unnecessary. But most of the wars were fought for territorial gain between the great powers of the periods past. Romans fought their wars to maintain the Roman Empire in every direction. And they always improved the countries that they took over and adopted their gods, you know, all but one instance. And that was when they didn't adopt the Christian religion at the same time that they took over Palestine. But the reason for that, I think, was that the Christians were practicing at that time actual communism, real communism, and the Romans were afraid that the situation would develop as a worldwide program, and so that's the reason they were persecuted, in my opinion. Not because of their religion, but because of their theories of government.
Would you describe genuine communism as practiced by the church and religion?
Yes, it's in the Acts of the Apostles. You'll find it in the first part of the Acts of the Apostles, in the King James Version of the Bible, in which it says that the Christians in Palestine put all their belongings into a pool and handed to the people the things that they needed when they needed them. And that's the first example of real communism. This present communism is a political organization, not a totalitarian basis. It has nothing whatever to do with communism.
That was social communism.
Yes, the real thing. And you'll find that in the Acts of the Apostles, in the King James Version of the Bible.
May I go back for a minute to that sense in which you discuss the possibility of doing away with wars when you can set up something by which you can enable agreements to come about. But don't you wish to add, because that's been part of your thinking, do you wish to add also an organization which will discourage ambitious dictators or ambitious men to conquer?
Oh, yes, that's what the organization of the United States of America under the Constitution did. It discouraged quarrels between the states after the war took place in 1861, 100 years ago. And I think that the United Nations was set up with the idea in mind that eventually it would come to the point where it can discourage difficulties between various governments in the world by negotiation and by a judicial decision on what's right.
Do you see that short of some kind of a world federation or a world union of nations or United States of the world? Or
I think that's what the United Nations is intended to be, Dave. I think that's what it's intended to be, and it'll take a while for it to work to that point. But eventually, I think it'll come to the point where it can enforce its decrees, as they're trying to do now in Congo.
Do you see, did you visualize it as you were helping to establish the United Nations, that it would grow into that kind of an organization?
Yes, that was what the League of Nations was intended to be. And when they turned it down, it ruined the whole situation, brought about the Second World War. And the organization of the United Nations was a continuation of the effort that was made by Woodrow Wilson in the League of Nations. And eventually, I think we'll come to the point where the world governments will settle their difficulties by negotiation instead of by shooting.
Mr. President, as I recall, on your first trip after you became president, your first trip out to the Middle West, you addressed a vast audience here in Kansas City. And you made what at that time was a startling statement that you believed that the world would eventually have to come to some form of United Nations similar-wise to what the United States was, in which there would be a federal government of all. You and still believe that?
What the League of Nations attempted to set up, it takes time to arrive at those conclusions. You see the beginning of the colonial organization. The colonies organized a situation where they all were supposed to work together, and it didn't work, so they made a stronger organization, which turned out to be the United States of America. League of Nations is the beginning. We turned it down ourselves. The United Nations is the next step, and eventually I think we've come to the point where we can settle things by judicial consideration and judicial decree rather than to go to shooting at each other.
Where are China and Russia the equivalent of our South of the days of yore, and do they pose the...
Well,
that seems a little unfair,
doesn't it? It's unfair to the South, but the situation is about the same because China and Russia are anxious to control the whole world themselves, and that's not what we want. We want a control that will have every nation, large and small, properly represented, so justice can be obtained under that situation. China and Russia want to control the world by conquest. No matter what they say, that's their objective.
You, I gather, don't think they're going to succeed in this.
No, they can't succeed as long as we stay together with our friends in the free world.
But we're not exactly together with our friends in the free world at the moment.
Well, we have our difficulties. Of course,
we were pessimistic about
that. We sit around and let the communists come in and organize right next door to us when it shouldn't have happened. And you find an article on that in one of the late economists, in which he makes a statement that if the situation had gone along as it should have done, Cuba might have been a state in the United States. It would have been so much better for Cuba if that had happened.
Well, a lot of the presidents have been wanting to incorporate that. A lot of pressure to take over Cuba as a permanent possession of the United States.
But in the case I'm talking about, it would have been voluntary. And their taking over would not have been taking over. It would have been just like Hawaii. They'd have come in as a state in the United States.
Would you care to speculate a little bit how you would have brought that about had you been president?
Well, that happened way back in the 90s, in the first of the century. And at that time, we had presidents in control who were not thinking on along that line. But it would have been a wonderful thing if Cuba had been kept as our friend and had wanted to become a part of the United States of America. Now, sometime they may do that.
Well, we
got rid of the present dictator.
Well, we had Cuba, and then we gave it up.
Well, yes. And it could have been handled exactly the same way that Puerto Rico was. Puerto Rico now is a free commonwealth in the United States.
For which you're responsible, Mr. President.
How's that?
For which you're responsible in solidifying.
I hope we are. I hope I am.
Well, now, let's jump a little bit from the explosion in the South, Civil War in which we're immediately involved, to the current explosion in Africa, which involves the same kind of situation.
That's true.
How do you relate those two?
Excuse me, may I ask you, what do you mean by the same kind of situation?
Well, there's an anti-slavery, an anti-colonialism movement, rebellion against subjugation by the people.
By the whites, although the Negroes themselves are subjecting some of their own people to a form of slavery.
Well, I don't think there's any similarity between a situation in Africa and what took place on the American continent for the simple reason that some of the powers who set up the colonial situation in Africa tried to educate the people for self-government. Britain in particular did that. Some of the rest of them did not. I don't think France or Belgium, either one, spent very much time trying to teach the people what they ought to know for self-government. As soon as they're educated to the point where they can govern themselves, I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be able to do it.
But you don't think that this is what triggered off our action in the South in 1863-64?
No, connection whatever in the same situation. It's an entirely different situation. And that's why the world moves. And these different situations have to be met under different conditions, but you won't know the history of what happened before because sometimes there are analogies, but not always.
Well, the trend is definitely towards freedom, self-government, and complete removal of all colonial power.
Well, that's the continuation of 1776, the revolution which set up the American government.
And you think that's still in chain reaction around the world?
No question about it.
Yes,
except in the communist countries.
Of course, what you're saying then is that whatever is happening in Africa now is a continuation of that spirit of move of the American Revolution in 1776, rather than paralleling the freedom of the slaves
right.
In the
I
South.
I think that's right. I don't think that has anything to do with it, but I think it does have a connection with the quotations that you were reading a while ago.
Now, get a little more of your appraisal of Lincoln as a person and as a leader. He seems to defy all the established patterns of what a leader ought to be like and dress like. Actually, he was totally neglectful of himself in terms of what he wore, excepting that broken down and very unkempt looking top hat, a very unpressed suit thrown together as if he were a kind of a what they call those things at the farm, scarecrow.
He was just a natural man, and he was himself. He didn't have any idea of appearing as something that he wasn't. And there's nothing in the world that's easier to discover than a stuffed shirt who's trying to be what he isn't. Lincoln was just what he was all the time, and that's the reason people liked him.
Maybe continue that in the next tape. This is the end of tape number 4, the morning of January 6, 1969.